Cairo Knights, as you probably figured out. My name's Saul Spady, and I'm filling in for the man, the myth, the legend, Jack Stein. You, of course, are the audience, and you're never filling in for anybody. You're just the text line. Not just. The text line is your vehicle to communicate with us. So 888-973-5476. Shane Peterson is running the show. And with that, well, we are trying to start off a conversation on the border. It's one of the hot topics in the United States. And whenever we discuss the border, we bring in a friend of the show, Allie Bradley. She's an independent journalist to be on Q13 Fox, but now she is flying herself out and generally telling us the truth as she sees it. Allie, you were telling off air, you just arrived in Texas again. How is it out there and where are you exactly?
Hi, Saul. Thanks for having me as always. And thanks for thinking this is an important topic to cover. I just got into Del Rio, one of the busiest sectors that we have been seeing along the southern border. I just got here late last night, boots on the ground early this morning. And I'll tell you what, it is hot. It is brutal out here. And, you know, I mean, I just witnessed a guy almost completely succumbed to dehydration and die right in front of me today. So thank God for our border agents and our law enforcement individuals that are responding to these situations, because it was a really scary sight today. And there was another woman that was also there that was 32 years old, who was diabetic and was having some major issues as well. And she needed medical support and medical transport as well. And so, you know, these guys out here on the front lines aren't just doing what a lot of people think they're doing and apprehending migrants. They are helping them and doing a service that, you know, any human being would do when seeing something like that. So today was a wild one. I ended up actually driving out towards Eagle Pass, which, if you guys have been following border coverage at all, you know that that has been a major kind of what they call surge point over the last few weeks. Well, it's kind of slowed down over there because Governor Abbott has an agreement with some of the states in Mexico to secure their side of the border as well. Now, we saw obviously some holes in that kind of plan, but does look like law enforcement has stepped up again on the Mexico side. So it's slowing down a little bit in Eagle Pass. But just about 10 miles outside of Eagle Pass, as I was driving out there, there was just a group of migrants sitting on the side of the road, about 50 of them, and Border Patrol was there, and they were, you know, working with them and starting the process of getting their information and their documentation. And they were telling me that that's kind of a new surge point that they're seeing. And over the last 3 days, they've seen roughly 500 people come across right there. And again, we've been seeing 100 degree temperatures and higher. So it's been really brutal out here. And there's a lot of kids out here, and they just don't have water. They don't have food. You know, I took some Gardettos out of my bag because that's the only thing I had to give to a little girl who was hungry. And so it is absolutely a humanitarian crisis out here. And sadly, it's only going to get worse. And today, Title 42 was extended. A Louisiana federal judge extended the health code that was set to expire on Monday. Now, under Title 42, that warrants basically immediate expulsions of migrants who qualify under the health code. It's mostly single adults under the Northern Triangle, which is El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And mostly people from Mexico are also sent back under Title 42. And so that was extended today. 22 congressional lawmakers, bipartisan actually, support a push to have this health code extended. Not necessarily because it's a pandemic era restriction, but it didn't have anything to do with the pandemic. More so that there wasn't a plan in place that they could see as a viable contingency plan should we see what DHS was anticipating of 18,000 people a day coming across our border. And so right now, my border agents are saying, you know, it's a good thing to kind of have this extended because they are already maxed out and extended. So they're happy to see the health code extended right now, but they're saying, you know, we'll see if it's enforced. Right now, they don't have the manpower to really do much for the enforcement side, and we're still seeing a massive influx. Now, on the other side, Saul, we have immigration advocates who are condemning the move by the federal judge, saying that, It's not right that these people aren't able to claim asylum in the 90 minutes that they have basically before they're kicked back across the border. So a lot of people have been advocating to lift the health code to allow for more people to be able to go through that process. So right now, once again, it is extended. I don't know how long it will be extended before it's looked at and assessed again. But based on this administration's track record, they will likely appeal it because they've been very vocal about that and will likely do what they say is enforcing it to the best of their ability.
Well, and this isn't just about adults. Obviously, children are a huge part of it. Over 144,000 unaccompanied children were processed in the fiscal year 2021. And then this is really fascinating, Ali. I'm curious of your take on it. But 12,000 children have reentered U.S. border custody as unaccompanied minors after previously being expelled to Mexico with their parents. So you have this almost case where parents are self-separating from their children to give them a better chance of reentry. What's your take kind of on the humanitarian crisis specific when it comes to children?
So, I mean, I think it's a really tough situation, right? Because we're saying parents are self-separating, but I literally witnessed a woman, a child through, my friend was FaceTiming me. I got to see it all happen because I was not boots on the ground at the time, but a two-year-old little girl came across by herself. She had her mother's name and phone number attached to her on a note card, but the mother wasn't in Mexico, Saul. She was all the way in Dallas already. So, you know, we are seeing kind of a mix of what that looks like. And the scary thing is these kids are falling into a criminal element. And there are kids that border agents tell me regularly that are what they say is recycled. So they're used to come across with families that aren't necessarily their own. There have been statistics in the past that these weren't their DNA, you know, their blood relatives. The problem is they don't do biometrics for people under 14. So it's hard to say, because I try my very best when I'm down here and I'm seeing children with families to watch and to assess the situation and see how they're responding and how they're acting. For the most part, from what I can tell with my eyes, the children belong to those families, right? They're breastfeeding them. They are, you know, putting them priority, feeding them, things like that ahead of themselves. To me, that's a family and a motherly, you know, response. However, we do know that the dark side is happening as well. And that's a scary side, because we aren't making sure that those kids are with people that are actually their families. Like I said, this woman who's in Dallas instructed someone to hand her child over to a random family in the river. And I don't know her situation. I don't know, but she was very nonchalant when the landowner that was with the child called her. And, you know, her story kind of changed in the coming days and the days following. So, you know, I try to give everyone the benefit of the doubt, but the reality of the situation is those, you know, when people come over with children, a lot of times they aren't expelled, you know, they aren't sent back. And so are these children that are kind of repeating coming across the border, coming across with blood relatives? We don't know that, because we are no longer doing biometrics, and biometrics is DNA testing on these children. And so it's really hard to tell. And in 2019, there were statistics that showed that, you know, more than half of those kids didn't belong to the families that they were with. And that's a scary statistic. And to not be doing that testing anymore, that ended out, you know, after the Trump administration, basically. And so to not be doing that, I'm not really sure why we aren't, because we do know that it's a very real thing.
It is a real thing. The border is probably, I would say, for me, it's what probably the top three issues in the United States. I don't know if you saw it recently, Ali, but there was a survey of the top issues in the U.S. And you know, I'm very passionate about affordable housing and homelessness. And immigration was, I think, one of the four issues. Number one, didn't ask any questions about housing and homelessness. When you see this immigration crisis, I mean, you and I both know that tied with this is a work crisis in America. We don't have enough jobs. There aren't enough people willing to work the job. Do you wonder, couldn't Congress find a middle ground solution that tries to get people into the United States in a legal manner as fast as possible, work, you know, starting wage job cities where people won't? Like, if we need people and there are people streaming across our border, why can't we do it in an organized manner? Or is that I guess it might be a bigger question than an independent journalist to solve.
That's a big, big chunk to chew on there. But I will say there's kind of a couple of things I will say. You know, this situation is going to contribute to the homelessness crisis. A lot of these folks, their addresses are an empty parking lot. When I ask the NGOs, hey, where are these people going? Have you checked in with them? Do you follow up and make sure they're safe? They don't. So they get kicked out in the interior. Most of them today alone, not one of them said they're going to meet with family. They're going to meet with friends, you know? And so these people can't necessarily take them in and things like that. So where are they going to go? And yet we don't allow them to work legally. So they are forced to work under the table if they want to work while they're here going through their process. Now, when you say, you know, there are jobs that Americans don't want to do, they have extended visas for a lot of those jobs. They have created more visas for more people to be able to do that want to work here legally. That is a thing. Now, on the flip side of that, I mean, the issue also is getting Americans back to work, right? But there's not a huge incentive for Americans to go back to work after the pandemic and things like that. So it's kind of a lot to process. I do believe, you know, that if these people are going to be allowed to come in and they want to work, that forcing them to work under the table is probably not the solution either. So, you know, allowing them to take a job where they have a skill set in, or allowing them to pay taxes and be part of that system, you know, I don't see a loss there, you know, and I don't put a lot of opinions towards things, but that's something that I see as everybody I talk to, they want to work. You know, they haven't come over and they said, oh, well, we just need help. They're saying we want to work. And they say it very empathic, like very much from the heart, that that's what they want to do. And that's just not even an option for them. You know, the Venezuelan families that I keep in touch with from the caravan I walked in, they are working under the table, you know, and their kids are in daycare and they're trying to do their life the best that they possibly can while they wait for their process, you know, and they would love to pay taxes. And they tell me that, and they're not really allowed. It's illegal until they get through their asylum proceedings to have a job on the books. And so that just doesn't really seem like it works and adds up to me.
And this is where I'll just get on, I guess, my horse here and try to share what I believe. We need to do better in the United States. We need to actually directly address the politicians that are trying to focus exclusively on maybe unsolvable issues, like where you stand morally on a woman's right to choose. Whatever your opinion may be, that is going to be a debate that can't be solved. We can figure out ways to help people get processed through the border. We can figure out better ways to get people jobs that are open right now. There is a huge job shortage in Seattle. And if there's somebody that wants a job, that can speak English, that's willing to work, we should be trying to expedite their process. And in the end, and there are many that may disagree with me, but we need to take complete control over the border. And actually, whether it's a wall or a smart fence or lots of well-processed doors, come up with a way that there is some organization. Because in a similar manner, by just allowing crossings that currently exist or allowing the large encampments that we have in Seattle, we're actually causing more chaos and empowering crime when we really should be putting a stop to it. Ali, is the border to you one of the top issues for the congressional races in Texas? And have you talked to any Texas congressional candidates, or have you seen any of them tromping along the border next to you?
I know it is one of the most contentious issues for Texas and for Texans, and it should be one across the nation, really, because it's not a Texas thing. It is everybody leaves Texas and the border whenever they arrive. So it has an impact on everybody, really. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people wrap their head around, is every single law enforcement individual I talk to says they get as far away from the border as possible, as quick as possible. So, you know, they're not staying in these border communities. Now, when it comes to, you know, law enforcement, or excuse me, people that are, you know, vying for an office and things like that, Governor Abbott, of course, has pulled out a lot of stops over this time frame, over this, you know, election cycle. And we've seen a lot of, you know, what some people call as grandstanding, if you will, and, you know, sending buses to D.C. The governor in Arizona also started doing the same thing. And so we are seeing really big moves like that. But a lot of people believe that, you know, these lawmakers down here are reacting, you know, instead of being proactive. They're trying to fix a situation that's been a problem in this area for quite a while. Now, you know, a lot of the things that Governor Abbott is doing, you know, sending these buses to DC, that's what America is mad about. These NGOs, you know, some of America is mad that these NGOs are doing, and the NGOs are saying, hey, this is a free ride for us to get to DC if these people have an East Coast destination. And so that's very real as well. Now, when it comes to, you know, House lawmakers and things like that, I have seen them down here via their Twitter and things like that, but I've never seen them with my own eyes in the last few months. So, you know, do I believe it's an important topic to them? Absolutely. Now, do I believe that they are working towards real solutions? I'm not sure. I haven't seen a lot of action outside of, you know, Governor Abbott with the buses and the razor wire, pretty much. And so, you know, we'll see what they're pushing for, but they've been putting a lot of their energy towards keeping Title 42. That's been the main focus. And so it'll be interesting to see now that that health code is remaining in place for the foreseeable future. It'll be interesting to see where these lawmakers put their energy and what they're going to be doing now that, you know, they've kind of, for lack of a better phrase, accomplished what they set out to do. So we will see. And I'm always welcome to those conversations with them. And I'm always welcome, you know, to have interview time and to, you know, listen to what they do have to say. But unfortunately, you know, I don't see a whole lot of lawmakers really down here and really none from the left side of the aisle, which is unfortunate because it is a very real, like we just said, a very real situation.
Well, as we close out, we got about a minute left. We're talking with Ali Bradley, Ali Bradley TV on Instagram, Ali Bradley TV, I believe, on Venmo, if you want to support her efforts. I've said many a times that we need to support our independent journalists or find a crowdfund mechanism. I'll leave you with this, Ali. I've said that if we see more politicians reaching across the aisle, you know, Republicans that are pro-choice in Washington, or in the case of Beto O'Rourke, who's running for governor, I think he could do really well to have a more Republican style immigration plan. And that would allow individuals who are concerned about that issue to kind of cross the demilitarized zone and maybe vote for somebody. We've seen kind of more of the same and ignorance towards the border, which I think will be one of the main reasons why Beto loses. 30 seconds. Do you wish more politicians were moderate or what? Like, what's your wish, Ali, outside of another ticket to the border?
Oh my gosh. But that's a tough one. I would say what's happening right now when what people, you know, what you're saying that people would want this moderate style. I mean, you look back and there were policies in place under very Democratic presidents that are not in place right now. I think it's just everyone's trying to do the opposite of Trump. And I think we have to stop doing that. And we have to start looking at what policies actually work for the country. And you were talking about, you know, abortion and people and their emotional things. Those are hard things to solve. We shouldn't be leading with our emotion on this either, because maybe they didn't like President Trump. This is a real issue that has been a political football for 40 years. And so they do need to come together and say, what's the real solution, regardless of what Trump wanted to do? Let's look at the policies that were in place. Did they work? Were they benefiting the US? Was anything going on under even Obama, when Obama was president? He was detaining people, he was deporting people. And now all of a sudden that is not happening really much at all. And so we've got to just stop leading with our emotion, I think, first and foremost, and do what's best for the country. Because right now, no one's winning in this situation except for the cartel. And that's a sad thing to say, and that's a sad reality to accept. And so if we can't come together on some kind of agreement here, that's what's going to continue to happen. And that criminal element is going to continue to infiltrate our country, not by way of migrants, but by way of actual cartel and actual, you know, criminals being in our country. And we're seeing that, and it's happening, and we're seeing people on the terrorist database getting apprehended here. It's a very real thing. It should not be an emotional thing at all. And that is my wish, is to put the emotions aside and just handle this.
Let's go down the tunnel and let's fix it. We do have a tiny ray of sunshine. We got to talk to Ali Bradley here on Cairo Nights about the border. Ali, thank you so much for joining the show. I appreciate you and your effort. And please do stay safe out there in Texas as you can continue to try to report on this almost unstoppable problem.
Thanks, Saul. Take care.
Well, take care. You take care out there on those roadways. My name's Saul Spady, just filling in for Jack Stein.
Welcome back to Cairo. My name's Saul Spady, and I'm filling in for Jack Stein. And you can usually tell I'm filling in for Jack when I talk about sports, because I've heard once and twice that the man who Cairo Knights isn't that big of a Seattle sports fan. I fill in by believing the Mariners will make the playoffs for over 20 years, and that the Sonics are going to come back tomorrow. In this case, we are talking about the Sonics, not necessarily the Bring Them Back movement, but a really exciting event that I'm personally working on with our guest, Brian Robinson. He helped start the Bring Back Our Sonics movement with his blog many, many years ago. We lost the team, and now him and I are teaming together to host George Carl, who's returning back to Seattle for his kind of, I'd say, Hall of Fame victory lap. And we're going to have a party in the Queen Anne's parking lot next Friday, so a week from now, starting off at 2 p.m. But the main meat of the event starts off right around 4:30, when we are going to be rebroadcasting the Utah Jazz versus Sonics Game 7 in the Western Conference Finals. And I've never been more excited. And Brian, I got to admit to you, as I welcome you to the show here, that I've actually never seen that game. So Brian Robinson, what's your take that I've never seen this game that we're going to broadcast to everybody here on Cairo Knights?
You know, Saul, I'm always amazed at how young you are. And my advice is always enjoy it, man. Your youth will go quickly. I'm sure a lot of people remember this game really clearly. It's George Karl's favorite game he ever coached. And this series against Utah in 96 is really foundational to my love of the Sonics ever since. It was just a fantastic series. And the fans really felt like we were making a difference. And we counted down Karl Malone's free throws. And it was just everything sports should be in the community.
So I have to ask you, were you actually at that game itself? Or were you watching it in like a bar with some friends?
I was at that game. I had promised my 13-year-old little brother that I would take him to a game all season. And he hit me up and said, "This might be the last game, right? You have to take me now." So I took my wife's little brother, and we went, and it was loud, and we cheered until we were sweaty and couldn't cheer anymore. And when we won, we hugged strangers, and it, again, just, yeah, we were there. Fantastic.
So for me, sports is synonymous with community. You and I both are in the political realm. We're both really passionate about homelessness. But one of the areas where we can always, you know, find friendship and camaraderie is our passion to bring back the Sonics, no matter where we may disagree politically. What does it mean to kind of create this community event? I know you've been at the really core of the grassroots Supersonics community, but now this is going to be pretty large scale. I mean, I believe, you know, when I did a kickoff that you attended for the Cracked's first game, which was really awesome and super exciting, but I believe this be just as vibrant. And I think that's a sign to how passionate Sonics fans are.
I mean, if you look at the guest list, this is just a huge event. It's all going to be for our nonprofit partner, Rise Above. They're hosting the event, and they're doing great work with youth and bringing trying to be positive mentors and influence youth through sports. And I think, like you said, community is the bedrock of all of this. And there's never probably been a time that our community felt more divided or more desperate. And I always feel like sports is one of the few things that can make a difference. And sports is one of the few things that can unite people. So there are going to be people here from vastly different spectrums who just remember where they were when George Karl was coaching that game, or who just love Gary Payton and Sean Kemp, who are both going to be there. There's going to be people who don't remember who Sean Kemp and Gary Payton are, but maybe they come because their dad told them all about it, or their dad will bring them, or their mom. And you can go over the guest list. You know everybody. This is as good a group as Sonics as has been together probably since 2012, when the Mariners put on an event. And this is a chance to actually be really close to them. And the cool thing about 96 and those ages, there's sports teams that are great and there's sports teams that are really like entrenched in the culture and the community. And the Sonics were just a deep, deep part of people's lives growing up back then. And so that's what we're hoping, is that people will come and celebrate George's Hall of Fame induction. They'll get to stand with him and watch his game and hear his opinions on it and talk to Sean Kemp. I hope everybody gets that chance. Yeah, it's a neat opportunity for the community, no doubt.
Well, and huge shout out to some of the sponsors who put it together. Obviously, Dick's Drive-In stepped up. Our friends at Simply Seattle, the group that does all of George's podcasts, Truth Plus Media, and it's just important. I strongly believe that when Sonics come back, and it is a when, not an if, everyone who is a part of these types of events will feel more empowered and more connected to the team than they ever imagined. And in a weird way, this is so weird, but like, because we don't have a billionaire owner, because no one really owns the team, there is no team. The team is just in like our hearts and minds, and we have more ownership than we ever could of a sports team. Like, it will be our Sonics more than it was before when they left. Do you kind of get that take, Brian, or am I just trying to make sunshine out of rain clouds?
You are right on when you use the word ownership. I hope that everybody who wanted and everybody tried feels some sense of ownership of this outcome when they come back, because I think it's when, not an if. Until then, I hope that everybody who tried and contributed feels some sense of ownership when they go to a Kraken game and go to Climate Pledge Arena, because so many people stepped up. And my conversations with people who are interested in owning the Sonics, I try to tell them that because of this journey we've been on together, because we've all been in the trenches, because we're also emotionally invested, we have the ability here in Seattle to create the greatest community of fans ever. The greatest community of fans ever that has ever existed because of the journey we've been on together. And that's why we want to be able to say we're at these parties together when we didn't even have a team and we were still celebrating and doing all the things that other cities are doing around their teams, just because we have each other.
And I'll tell everyone, I'm going to be emceeing the event, and I'm going to emcee it in a silly way. Like, I don't know what's going in the game, because I'm going to watch the game like it's the main attraction. I know some people might be coming to just have unity, just to hang out, but I'm excited. I've had people reach out to me, and this is one of my favorites. A guy is 28 who doesn't remember the game, but this is his favorite team. And I think this opportunity will cement that forever for this individual who's a big fan of the drive and of the team. And so it's just, if you were a dad or a mom who watched the game and saw it, like, bring your kids and share this, because you're going to be bringing your kids to that opening at Climate Pledge Arena when the Sonics come back. And like Brian said, you will be an owner of that moment more so than if you didn't attend. Any kind of final takeaways, Brian? I know you have worked with the Kraken this year. Climate Pledge is through its first year. They did incredible work to open it up. What makes you excited about the next year?
You know, just to give credit to me, I didn't actually work with anybody. I just supported them. But it's really hard to do all this stuff. And a lot of people are working really hard to bring back the Sonics and worked really hard to get that building open. No one's going to get ahead of the commissioner, but all signs kind of point in good directions for us. There's lots of recent reports indicating that expansion is on the horizon. And so I would tell people to buckle up and have fun. And we really deserve this ride up. And Saul, I want to tell you, thank you really personally, because I took my kids to that opening night Kraken event at Dick's Drive-In. And I've got kids that are, my daughter was 18 and my son was 21. And it was our first time in a beer garden together after a global pandemic at Dick's Drive-In, just like I went to when I was a kid. And it was a really, really special moment. And Dick's was the right spot for it. And it kind of cemented some ties between our generations. So I guess I would say, thanks, man. I really had a great night there, and I hope we do it again next Friday.
We are doing it again next Friday. To your work, the Beer Garden case is going to support Rise Above. Good friends of ours, Jackie McCormick and Brad Myers, are behind that organization, just trying to get people into the game of basketball all around the state that are kind of from hard-to-do backgrounds. And it's, I will tell you, for everybody who's listening, if you think Dick's Burger tastes better after a beer or two, we'll watch the Sonics. It definitely will. So I hope everybody joins Brian and I hope to raise a toast to George Carl together and just have a party. Let's create a scene that somebody's going to write an article about, because it's so real that we're watching a play game like it's real, even though it might have occurred a few years back. So with that, Brian, thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for joining. What's your final word?
George Carl deserves this great party because the Hall of Fame is a big deal, and he's just as cool of a guy as people would think he would be.
With that, we're going to be celebrating George. We're going to be celebrating Gary. We're going to be celebrating Sean Kemp. It's going to be a big deal. Come see us next Friday. Either way, this is Chiron, and we're always celebrating the return of the Sonics, even if it hasn't happened yet. My name's Saul Spady. I'm filling in for Jack Stein. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. My name is Saul Spady, just filling in here for Jack Stein. Usually, almost always, this is Shane's World, but I got a text message in that I feel very personal about and that I want to respond to. And so Shane has done a good deed, and he's let me step in and pinch it on his world. So I appreciate you, my friend. Thanks for giving me a try on this here Shane's World.
Anytime.
With
man.
That being said, wait, what's that, Shane? I'm sorry.
Oh, you're all good. I just said, anytime, man.
Oh, you know it. You know it. You're the man, the myth, the legend, Shane Peterson. So here's the deal. I mentioned that I'm pro-choice, pro-gay marriage, and pro-cannabis, and that I believe that our cities are run poorly and that the Democrats that are running our cities are anti-growth. That's why I consider myself to be pro-growth conservative. I am in favor of a woman's right to choose. The 360 writes, you're pro-choice because you're young. Try witnessing a live ultrasound and come talk to me. 360, I have experienced watching my partner have a miscarriage after 3 months. I have seen a live ultrasound. I strongly believe in the miracle of life, but I am very confused by many individuals, and maybe you aren't this type of individual, but who are pro-life, but they are not pro-life after birth. They believe that a woman who has been raped should have to give birth to that child, but they don't care what happens to that child after they're born. They don't care if that child has universal health care. They don't care if that child gets a good education. In fact, they probably don't care that there are high rates of death among children between 0 to 2 who are born to people who are extremely poor. That means that when you are pro life and you believe that a child has to be born, if you're actually not pro-life after birth, you're just dooming that poor soul to a potential death they didn't deserve that may be far, far worse than whatever experience occurs in the womb. And I'm not saying what happens when you have a miscarriage or when you have an abortion isn't devastating, isn't emotionally trying, isn't hard. I strongly believe that we as a country, if we are pro-life, should do everything we can to prevent bad pregnancies. We should be giving free birth control. We should encourage people to use Plan B if they make a mistake. We shouldn't deny being safe. We should actually celebrate those who live their lives with freedom, but with an education to that freedom that doesn't accidentally bring in a new life. Strongly would like you all who are pro-life to consider the children that die after they are born to families that aren't in a place to support them. Give me a good answer on how you want to change America to better take care of those children that you feel have to be born to those poor families who then may or may not pass because of a society that is unwilling to care for them after birth. I'm pro-choice because I believe in women's rights. I believe that we should give men and women an opportunity to choose when they take on the economic burden that is being a parent. And I strongly, strongly believe that both sides should do a much, much better job of caring about the child after birth. I'm saying it over and over again. I might be a broken record, but that is where I have lost connection with the pro-life movement. If the pro-life movement, an incredibly creative way to do universal healthcare, maybe everyone in America gets catastrophic insurance. So they're guaranteed to be able to go to a doctor if something bad happens. So that, let's say, if a parent who gives birth to a child who doesn't have good healthcare is afraid to go to the doctor, well, that wouldn't happen because they would just go and save their child. Please, all of you, whatever you may feel about pro-life or pro-choice, don't respond the way the 360 does. I'm not pro-choice because I'm young, and it's not because I haven't witnessed a live ultrasound. I'm pro-choice because I believe we should be doing more for those who are born after birth than we should be doing trying to force them into a world for a parent that doesn't want to have them. It's all very sad. It's all very hard. Text in if you disagree, 888-973-5476. My name's Saul Spady, just filling in for Jack Stein here on Cairo Nights.